tape is produced in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry the message. Members of the fellowship will bear in mind AA's 11th tradition regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films in the use of this tape. Anonymity to this extent is actually the practice of genuine humility. We are sure that humility expressed by anonymity is the greatest safeguard that AA could ever have.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Lorna, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be here, and the first things first, my manners. So let me thank the committee so much for inviting me to speak. And you know, Janet said we have a great speaker, and I don't want to set up an argument, but I'm certainly not a great speaker. I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, when I first came to the program and I first qualified, I remember thinking and I remember saying, you know, I hope there's something I can say that will help you today. And I now know, you know, there's nothing I'm saying or do that's helping you so much as Jim was talking about, but you give me the privilege of standing here to have myself reflected, and thereby I get helped. So thank you very much once again. When I first qualified, you know, after I finished speaking, I used to think to myself, good God, the next time I speak, I must get my story straight. And there's no getting it straight. I see my story differently all the time. What I think of the program and how I feel I should work it changes all the time, and my hopes and dreams change all the time. And it's constantly changing. My view is constantly changing. For instance, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous ruined my childhood. I had a perfectly nice childhood before I came into AA. In fact, I wasn't even an alcoholic before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And but, you know, as I got sober and I started viewing my past, I started looking at this family I'd grown up in, and they got worse and worse and worse. And in the end, you know, my parents sort of took on these demonic proportions, and I felt very privileged and like relieved that I thought, my God, you know, how incredible that I survived such a dreadful childhood. And now it's come full circle, and I feel very blessed that I had the parents I had, and I had a very wonderful childhood. And you know, before I came into the program, I felt I had absolutely no worth at all. And then as I got more sober and I hung around you and I listened to you, I had myself reflected with you, I felt that I did have worth and I was worthy and I did deserve. And now it's come full circle, and I feel, not to sound too sort of Teresa of Avila about this, but I feel really totally unworthy for the gift I've been given. There's nothing in my life that I have done in this particular lifetime that I can see that in any way warrants the magnitude of the gift I've been given. There's nothing. You know, my sponsor, she said to me, there were two things she never want to hear out of my mouth. One of them was, it's hard for me. You know, it's hard for me to make a commitment. It's hard for me to make phone calls. Oh, I don't like writing the fourth step. I'll do it in my head. You know, it's hard for me to be friendly, all that sort of stuff. And she'd say, you know, honey, it's hard for us all, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous is not for the faint-hearted. And then the other thing she never wanted to hear out of my mouth were the words, I deserve. I deserve to be happy. I deserve a nice relationship. I deserve a good job. I deserve to live in a nice place. She said, honey, if you got what you deserve, she said, you can be grateful that you have a God of mercy and not a God of justice. So, but I still whine a bit. But, you know, as Jim was talking about service, I thought there was a fabulous talk he gave, actually, about service. And I was seeing, I think, you know, really how madly important each individual is and how insignificant. Both those things go hand in hand. And, you know, I've never spoken about this because it happened fairly recently, but something remarkable happened to me earlier this year. I was invited to speak in Thailand. I know that sounds very exotic, but the actual fact of it wasn't. But anyway, I was in... after I spoke, I was in Bangkok, and I was staying at the house of an AA member, and I got very ill. And usually when I travel in those sorts of countries, I've got a cast-iron stomach. I mean, I came down with the flu, and it was very hot. And if you know, being ill in tropical heat is just god-awful. It's awful enough, but there, it was just terrible. And I was at the peak of the illness, where, you know, you feel like you've been in the ring with Muhammad Ali or Mike Tyson or something. And I felt, you know, every bone ached, you know, my earlobes ached. And I was lying up on the bed just sweating profusely and feeling god-awful. And she came into the room and she said to me, Lorna, I just got a call from the office and there's a woman has called and she wants some help and she's reached out and I need to go on this 12-step call. I can't find anyone else. Would you please come? So I said, oh, all right. So I rolled off the bed and I rolled into her truck. And I hadn't brushed my hair, I hadn't changed my clothes, I sweat, I looked a mess. And very bedraggled. And we got to this woman that we're bumping through the streets of Bangkok. And, you know, I'm feeling so god-awful. And we got to this woman's apartment, and she was an English woman whose husband was working on a contract in Thailand. And she met us. She wasn't drunk, but she certainly wasn't sober. And she was in the weepy stage. And my friend wanted me to do most of the talking because I had longer sobriety and was more, she just thought, you know, I knew more. So this woman started to talk. And I felt so ill, I went, please, you know, I just don't want to hear what you have to say. You know, I just, you know, and my attitude was, lady, I've got a message to deliver. I feel so sick. I'm going to deliver this message, and I'm out of here. And, you know, usually I'm a little kinder and a little more compassionate, and I'll let them tell me their story and all that, and I tell them my story. But I just couldn't be bothered to hear her. And I'm telling my story. And at one point I said to her, look, I feel so god-awful, I'm going to lie down on the floor. And I was lying on the floor, 12-stepping her from the floor. And I just want to say this. You know, at one point she looked at me and she said to me, you are so beautiful. She said, you're so wonderful. She said, if I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, can I be like you? And I remember thinking, this woman is not seeing what I am. Do you know, I truly, it was such a lesson to me that I, whatever it is she's hearing, is not what I'm feeling. And I truly am a messenger. And you know, whenever I take a newcomer to a meeting, I always hope they hear the perfect sponsor. I make sure they take the perfect speaker, rather. I want to take them to the perfect meeting, want to introduce them to the correct people. And that woman had a few bounces in and out, but she's been sober and she's now in the program, and it had nothing to do with me. I mean, I know it had nothing to do with me, except, you know, as Jim said, I stayed sober that day. And I'm here to tell that story. So, you know, that's my little tale of service. Anyway, I guess the thing to do is to be very classic. I, and in the telling of my story, and to share my experience, my strength, and my hope. And my experience is that I woke up one Sunday morning in the summer in New York, and I'd had a girlfriend staying with me overnight, and I couldn't wait to get rid of her. And finally, she left. She lived out of town, probably in Connecticut or something. I don't know. Anyway. And as soon as she left, I went down to the local bodega and I bought myself a carafe of a container of Tropicana. And I came back upstairs and I made myself a jug of Tropicana and vodka. And I poured myself a tumbler full of the stuff and drank it. And as that first drink, you know, went down and it hit my empty stomach, and the fingers sort of came back up and caressed my soul. My soul went, oh, you know, I can keep it at bay just one more day. I can keep it going just one more day. I can fool them one more day. And I drank most of that jug of wine, that jug of vodka and orange juice. And I had a date with a fellow that I was dating at that particular time, and I just want to sidetrack to tell you about this romance in my life. I had been married, and the marriage had broken up. Actually, you know, I always say my husband walked out the door, and I thought it was the most fascinating thing he'd ever done. It really caught my attention, you know. I wanted to get this fellow back. I guess I wanted to get him back to torture him some more. But a friend of mine had told me that she had been to a meeting of Al-Anon. And she said to me, you know, Lorna, all the women sound just like you. So I went off to this meeting of Al-Anon, and I was very interested. And, you know, in Al-Anon, they suggest that you go to open AA meetings. So I used to go to open AA meetings. And I was fascinated with AA. I was just intrigued with all these stories and what people got up to. And I truly think that that's the thing that tells us we're an alcoholic. I don't think it's how much I drink or what I do with the drinking, or if I hide bottles or if I stash bottles or if I, you know, drink in the morning or anything to do with alcohol. I think if you want to come into these rooms and listen to stories about people vomiting on the bathroom floor and throwing up on their bosses and, you know, getting fired and attempting suicide and all that stuff, and you're fascinated with it, there's something the matter with you. You know, if you want to come and listen to it again, it's a little sick. And but anyway, I was very interested in AA, and I worked at I had this very smart job. I worked at Sotheby's Art Auction House, and in those days they were on Madison Avenue, and right across the street from us was the Carlyle Hotel. and they had Bemelman's Bar. And what I really loved to do was I loved to go over there after work because I loved drinking on an empty stomach, you know. And I'd go over there after work and have that first drink after work. And then when I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in there after work and I'd say, ooh, it's almost 7:30. I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll be back. And I went up the road to a meeting in New York. It was considered sort of the silk stocking meeting at the time. It was called Lenox Hill. It's still there. And I'd been listening to these stories and so intrigued, you know. And I'd come back to the bar in anonymity to the wind. I mean, I had no idea. I'd say, well, you'd never guess who is an alcoholic. And I'd tell details about their story. I mean, I was so out to lunch, you know, meanwhile drinking my screwdriver. But anyway, so I was familiar with AA. So getting back to this story, this husband of mine had left, and I was dating this other fellow. And I wanted to marry him. The fact that he hadn't even mentioned it, that never sort of crossed my mind, but I wanted to marry him because he had the one thing in the world I wanted. And that wasn't sort of noble feelings about me or a great love of me, or gentlemanly behavior, or wonderful upstanding character. No, the thing he had that I wanted was he had a maid. And I wanted someone to lay my clothes out. I wanted someone to run my bathwater, to brush my hair, to put my food on the table, to wake me up, to tell me it was time. I was very busy, you understand. I didn't have time for all this nonsense. And and I was so fascinated because, you know, I was a very heavy smoker. And in his house, always, every chair you sat in, there would be beside the chair a table, and on the table was a little silver container of loose cigarettes, a lighter that always worked, and an ashtray. And I was always looking for one or all three of those things. And the maid did it. And I was willing to, you know, I was willing to let this man touch the sacred temple in order to get to the maid. And, you know, in some circles they call that prostitution. So, and I remember, just as a, you know, as a typical sort of woman's take on this in a story, you know, I don't have any bell-clanging reality about my drinking. I didn't sort of hit bottom in an ambulance with sirens going or come through in a detox or anything like that. There was nothing really dramatic about my drinking. My drinking was shabby and seedy and wimpy and mucky, real mucky. And one time I was with this fellow, and I'd stayed over at his house on a Saturday night, and, you know, we'd been intimate with each other, and what did I know about? I mean, did I know anything that was sacred about intimacy with another human being and the thing of my body and, you know, I mean, what did I thought, you know, coffee, bagel, and intercourse. I mean, it just, it was sort of all on the same level, you know. And so I'd stayed over to his house on this Saturday night, and Sunday morning, a morning much like this, I got up, and I just want to paint this whole sleazy scene. I'm in his silk dressing gown, in his den, curled up on the sofa, reading the New York Times, while he is on the phone with another woman making a date for that afternoon. And, you know, I can say what a creep he was, and not a very nice sort of fellow. But that's where I was. That's the level I was at. And that's what I was attracting into my life. And you know, I can tell where I'm at and what my life is like by what I have and who I have in my life. I think I was always waiting for someone to come along to elevate me. I was always waiting to sort of be discovered in the typing pool. You know, I have to become that level in order to attract that level. So anyway, I was this particular Sunday morning, I was going to have brunch with this fellow. You know, that when he was making a date with that woman for that afternoon, of course, that wasn't the end of the relationship. Of course not. You know, I stayed in there for lots more abuse. It reminds me, actually, of an Al-Anon story I heard just recently, and it was that these two women were going to the zoo, and one went up to the gorilla's cage, and they both went up to the gorilla's cage, and one put her hand through the bars, and the gorilla grabbed her hand and yanked her through and took her in the back and molested her and abused her and just ravaged her. And finally, the zookeeper came, and they took her off to hospital, and a few days later, the friend thought, you know, I better go and visit her. So she went into the hospital room and visited her, and she said, oh, and this poor friend, was, her neck was in a brace, and her legs were up on a truss, and she was battered and black and blue all over, and her friend said to her, my God, you must be in so much pain. And she said, oh, I am. She said, he hasn't called, he hasn't written. So that was me. You know, I'm in Al-Anon also. So anyway, I was supposed to have brunch with this fellow on this particular Sunday, and I had brunch with him. It was very messy and just one of those miserable sort of Sundays. I left him and I had nothing to do, and it was an endless summer Sunday where the sun wasn't going to set for ages, and it was a long time since I'd had any friends invited me anywhere, and I was totally, totally alone. You know, bottom isn't necessarily the worst day of one's drinking. I don't know what constitutes bottom. It's just a terrible, terrible emotional thing. You know, very often, and I'm sure all of us have been in rooms, I know I have, say classically, I've heard some guy talk about being in a terrible car accident, and he'll say, you know, I had the last rites read, and I was in a coma for 5 days, and they gave me so many transplants, and I had ribs broken and part of my spleen removed, and then he says, you know, but that wasn't to be the end of my drinking. And you're sitting there gasping, and he says, you know, I was to drink for another 10 years. And he said, but you know, one morning I walked out and the neighbor looked at me cross-eyed, or I missed my child's basketball game or something, and that did it. So you know, we can never judge the magnitude of anyone else's bottom. It can just be an inflection. And for me, it was this August Sunday, and it was just a dreary, the sun was blazing, it was a beautiful day, people were out in New York, but it was the dreariest day of my life. And in the evening, I had nothing to do, and I went to an AA meeting. I wasn't in AA, but I knew that they were around, and I'd been used to going because I wanted to get this husband of mine back while I was still going out with this other fellow. You can see I'm really confused. And so I went, and I heard a woman share, and she shared up to where I was at that point, and then she went on. For another 15 years, she went on. And I was horrified, and I saw that she was me and I was her. And I remember running out onto Lexington Avenue, and I ran into a bar and I had another drink very quickly. And I went out and drank for the rest of that night. And I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. And I couldn't shake what I'd heard in that meeting on 31st Street and Lexington Avenue. That all that time I'd been going to AA, I mean, it was about 2 months by then, and that I suddenly thought, oh my God, you know, I drink. And the next day I went to a meeting and I walked in and I said to the woman, I'm here for myself. And I used to end my story there. I used to go on and then talk about sobriety. And but when I was 15 years sober, I went had the worst pain I've ever known in my life. Something happened to me that kicked off, you know, subterranean fields of pain. And I always say, you know, it was all the pain that I'd never allowed myself to experience through countless lifetimes, and all the pain that I'd ever dished out to others, I got to feel. And the pain was relentless. And, you know, I think I'd had a lot of spiritual pride up until that time, especially as far as the program goes. And I want to say to you, you know, this is very, very general. There are 8 million stories in the Naked City. This is just one of them. But I often find that people, after they've gone into, after the 10-year mark, and they enter the teens, it's like, you enter your teens. I was talking to some friends this morning about their teenage son, and they sort of raised their eyes to the ceiling and, like, you know, and getting through the teens is a work. It's then, you know, often you find that people in the program get into great despair. They're in terrible pain, and all the things that they've ever used suddenly don't work. And, you know, the big book flew out the window. My sponsees became my sponsors. And all the things that I'd ever known how to do, I mean, I know how to meditate, I know how to pray, I'm a practicing Catholic, I love going to Mass, it meant nothing to me. And it just, I couldn't do any of those tools, any of them. Working with newcomers just left me feeling dry. No service, nothing. And the only thing God left, and I think I had to really learn, I think no matter how much I mouthed it, that somehow there was this kernel in me that said, there's a way you do this. There's a method to staying sober. There's, if you can catch on to the way of doing it, you are guaranteed. It's a course. Once you've gone through all these steps, you are guaranteed. But I know now that no matter how many sponsees I have, no matter how many chairs I put up, no matter how much service I do, no matter how many big books I read, no matter, you know, whether I knew what Dr. Bob said to Bill Wilson on such and such a date, no matter what I do, I put my head on the pillow every night, and guess what? I still have alcoholism. And I cannot do this thing. All those things help, and they support. But in the end, it's not me that decides how I get sober. It's I am here totally, totally by the grace of God and by your grace in sharing your experience, strength, and hope with me that I can identify. And it took me 15 years to really, really get it. And God left me with two things in that time. He left me with smart feet. And my feet took me to meetings, and I screamed, and I cried, and I carried on, and I couldn't believe, and other people couldn't believe. You know, it lasted 4 years for me, this agony, and people would nudge each other and say, how long does she have? You know, 16 years, 17 years, and she's still talking about that? My God. You know, I certainly don't want what she's got. And and the other thing God left me with, the other great thing, I was rendered totally, totally helpless. And every time I went to do something, it went out of my grasp. You know, Mother Teresa and I were very close friends, and I have been to India many, many times and worked in Calcutta. So when I was in this pain, I went to Calcutta at one time because I thought, well, that'll really get me out of it. You know, I was always looking for an angle I can get out of it. No matter what, I'll do something really noble. I went off to Calcutta, and, you know, I even started getting jealous of the lepers, you know, but they were somehow better off than me. I could not, this pain just focused me on myself. I could not see out. And Mother was very, very kind to me, and I just couldn't work. I just couldn't. And see, I just thought, I kept on thinking, if I get the right combination, I will get out of this pain. If I do step 4 and 5, it'll get out of this pain. I kept on thinking of an angle. None of it worked. And I remember a few months after that, Mother came to New York and we met, and she asked me, she said, "How is it going for you?" And I said, "Mother, it's hell. It's absolute hell." And she said, "Ooh," she said, "how God must love you." She said, "And he wants to be very intimate with you, but he is a jealous lover, and he is burning out of your soul everything unlike himself." And I said, "Well, gee, that's swell, Mother. But I wish he'd stop kissing me quite so passionately here." And you know, I had to have burned out of my soul every idea that I know how to do it, that I have an answer for it. If you're in this sort of pain, you know, I used to say to people, "Oh, you're in that sort of pain, but why don't you do a fourth step on that? If you write a fourth, and if you're in pain, there must be," you know, and I wanted to address people that are maybe in the program a little while. We think that, God, if I'm in pain, I must be doing something wrong. But I think recovery is very much like drinking. You know, there comes a time when drinking works for us, there comes a time when it's very useful, then it comes a time when it turns on us. And then it comes a time where you can't get drunk and you can't get sober. And then all those things that I learned how to do just didn't work. And I thought to myself, there's something wrong with me. I used to be able to do a fourth step, and it went. I used to be able to 12 step, and this pain relieved. Why doesn't it work anymore? Because it's not meant to work. And you know, I think there are a few dopey sayings that have come up in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're not program, and you know, everyone has a different opinion, but this is mine. And one of the dopiest sayings, I think, is, "God doesn't give me any more to handle in a day than I can possibly handle." And, you know, just say that to the child in Northern Ireland that's seen their father blown up. Or say that to some Vietnamese girl that's been raped on the high seas. Or say that to, I'm sure there's somebody in this room that's lost a child. There's, you know, there's plenty that God gives us individually and as a group more to handle than we can handle. And I was given it, I think, precisely because I had to learn not to handle it. I'm not supposed to handle it. If I'm in the third step, my life is none of my business. And I had to get to that point, you know. So the other thing God left me with at that particular time was a memory of my last drink. Now, I'd gone for 15, 16 years with thinking my last drink was that Sunday I just described. But in that terrible pain, I remembered my last drink. And I always knew I'd had another drink after that Sunday, but I just didn't want to talk about it because it wasn't really significant, and it was just a little sip and it wasn't really important. And, you know, I often used to describe myself as, I wasn't such a big alcoholic because I was a periodic. Well, you know, being a periodic alcoholic is like having a periodic nuclear war, do you know? So whether one drinks a jug or a sip, it's the same. So So, where was I up to about the periodic news? Oh, this particular. Oh, that's right. I remembered my last drink. I'd been sober about 9 or 10 days, and I was on business in Washington. And when the business was over, the fellow I was with and I, we had dinner at one of his relatives' houses. Lived down there, I think it was his brother-in-law. And at the dinner, there were about 5 or 6 of us for dinner. There was a goblet in front of our places. This beautiful, big, thin glass goblet, and wine was served. Now, I didn't know enough to say, no thank you. I didn't know enough to actually pick it up and put it away. I didn't know to say, I'm not drinking, do you have anything else? I didn't know that. I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was all about learning how to resist alcohol. I thought I was supposed to be in this program to learn how to act casually around alcohol. To say, oh, no, please go ahead. Doesn't bother me. I thought I was supposed to learn how to be cool around it. To develop an attitude of superiority. Well, no, I don't drink. I've overcome that sort of thing. I thought I was supposed to develop this sort of platonic relationship, or pretend that I had a platonic relationship with alcohol, negating the fact that alcohol and I had had this incestuous dance together. And I didn't understand, with that length of sobriety, the magnificence and the mystical nature of surrender and powerlessness. I didn't know. I just thought it was about resisting. So, I resisted it through the salad, and I resisted it through the main course, and I resisted it through dessert. And then people were sitting around, you know, drinking coffee and chatting. And suddenly, this goblet of wine started talking to me. And it said to me, oh, Lorna, you always make such a big fuss. You're always so bloody dramatic. What are you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous for your simple problem? I mean, you're not... why do you always go overboard? I mean, you're not an alcoholic, for God's sakes. You know, you're always so dramatic. I'm not your problem. You are your problem. I'm on your side. You know, don't you always feel better when we're together? Don't you always feel prettier? Don't you feel like you can speak better? I'm not against you. I'm with you, Lorna. I'm with you. And your problem is you. You know, why do you always guzzle? Why do you knock it back? Why can't you sip? And do you see the other people at this table, you know, weeping and telling each other inappropriate details of their personal life? No? Do you see them acting inappropriately? No. And look at Maureen. She's just had that one drink all this time. Why can't you be like her? And I said, you know, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I picked it up and I took a sip. And whereas 10 days before, that whole day of drinking vodka and orange juice had not, you know, had sort of like eased my soul, but hadn't satisfied me, this one sip sent my soul into total, utter terror. Terror. And the terror was, I always describe it, it was almost as though with that one sip, these huge doors, these great big sort of metal, thousands of pound gates, came, released from their moorings, and they slowly came shuntering across the film of my life. And I could see that they were going to shut with this great thud, this irretrievable closing. And I was going to be on one side and you were going to be on the other. And no matter how much I screamed and pounded, you were not going to be able to hear me. It wasn't that you wouldn't let me back in. It's that you wouldn't be able to hear me. And I felt like an astronaut severed from the mothership and just sort of floating out there. I didn't know about sobriety. I didn't particularly want to be sober because I didn't drink. I didn't know anything. All I knew was that I wanted to be with you. All I knew was that I wanted to be in here. And I went back to New York on Amtrak. And all the way back to New York, I wept in that train. And I cried and I cried and I begged God to let me back in the program. I said I would do anything. Just don't cut me off. I'll even not drink. Just don't. Please let me be in AA. And I came back on the following day and I threw my suitcase into the office and I went back to this meeting called Lenox Hill and I sat in the front row. And it was a very old meeting, and a lot of old sort of blue-haired ladies there and that sort of thing. And some chap came up to me and he said, you can't sit there. He said, Harriet and Henry, whatever their names were, he said, have been coming to Lenox Hill for the last 20 years, and they always sit in those seats, and you can't sit there. And I don't remember much about this fellow, but I just remember that he was the sort, he had trousers on with little spuming whales embroidered in his trousers. And I said to him, I don't care who sits here, I'm here now and I'm not leaving. And I don't know where I got the gumph to say that, you know, that was 23 years ago and I haven't left yet. But I have sat in different chairs. And I do recommend that if you have a group and you always sit in the same chair, move. see the room from a different point of view. You know, it's an attitude on seeing life from a different point of view. Anyway, I came across, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous and you know, I had an awful lot to to learn and to know. I got the perfect sponsor. My sponsor never made me do anything. She never told me I had to get in touch with my story because I couldn't see my story. It, for anyone in the room that's new, it took me 2 years to really grasp my drinking story. It took me 2 years to think, ooh, well, maybe that was... Maybe that wasn't falling asleep at the dinner table. Maybe that was passing out. You know, when I came in the program, I thought that I'd had a little problem with alcohol for maybe, 6 months maybe. And then as I got more sober, my story went back further and further and further, where now, you know, I think I should have been taken from the delivery room to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I like to say, you know, that really I believe that as I came down the assembly line of heaven this time, God saw me coming by on the conveyor belt and he said, ha ha, you. He said, you know, I have longed for you. I have waited patiently through eons for you. And this time you're going to want me to. This time you're going to love me. And as I came by, he went, chung, chung, and he stamped me alcoholic. And I don't think I had a chance. So, and I know that because, you know, I have a brother and a sister, and you talk to them, and you'd think we'd grown up in totally different households. They have a completely different view of life in my house than I had, and I always felt, you know, I had the typical whine of every alcoholic. I always felt different. I didn't feel like I fit in. And you know, the truth is, I was different, and I didn't fit in, and it's the truth. So anyway, I came in, I had this perfect sponsor, and this sponsor knew that she was dealing with someone that couldn't take, I just couldn't see that I drank, and I knew I wasn't like you, you know. I mean, for instance, she told me to get the alcohol out of my house, and I said, Ellen, really? You know, you are going, I mean, I had this very highfalutin job at Sotheby's, and she was punching out tickets at Pan Am, and she wore polyester skirts and things, you know, and I said to her, I said, Ellen, really, you know, if you suddenly told me I was allergic to diamonds, would you tell me to get the diamonds out of my house? And she said to me, well, listen to you, equating alcohol with diamonds. I think maybe you have a problem. Get it out of the house. And I just want to say, you know, about the alcohol in the house, I always like to say, because I had a bad accident when I was about 10 months sober. I was doing some ironing. I opened the ironing board. There was a loose piece of metal, and it went right through my thumbnail. And it was that heart-stopping pain. And the computer of my program, my AA computer, just crashed. I mean, it just wasn't there. It was gone. And I went on automatic, and I went to the cupboard to get out the alcohol, and it wasn't there because I'd done what you told me to do. And, you know, I was able to bandage. I mean, the blood was going, but I'm reaching for the bottle, you know, so I was, because it wasn't there, I'm able to bandage it and do the right thing. And, you know, very often alcoholics will say, well, just because I've stopped drinking doesn't mean to say I want to impose that on my friends. And when my friends come by, I want to be able to offer them a drink. Well, you know, people that don't smoke don't keep cartons of cigarettes in the house. And Orthodox Jews do not keep ham and Swiss cheese in the fridge. And Muslims don't have a side of pork in the freezer. And I've yet to go, it's a yet for me, but I've yet to go to someone's house and they have little piles of cocaine and heroin on the coffee table and hypodermic needles and bandages, and they say, well, we don't shoot up, but maybe you'd like to. Yeah. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's something about me. You know, I read a preamble every day that says that I want to be available and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I don't wear things around my neck. I don't have anything around me. I don't have a big AA tattooed on my forehead. I don't have anything that says I'm an alcoholic. The only thing that says about it are my actions and where I can be found. And, you know, it's very imperative for me that there's something about me that's different. I am different. And I think a lot of my pain has come by trying to be like other people in the world and by living by other people's standards, like the standards are, you know. Very often, we all know we get our dreams. We get the relationship or the job or the car or whatever it is, or the children, and we wake up in the morning and think, oh, you know, there's something dissatisfying, and it's because it will never be enough for us. Will never be. And you know, I'm not like other people. I am different. I've been raised from the dead. I'm not ordinary. And I didn't get raised from the dead because I'm so wonderful. I didn't get this gift because I'm such a precious person. I got this gift because it was so dreadful. And I turned my back on everyone and everything, and even myself. I couldn't stand myself. You know, when I came into the rooms, there was that song out, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. You know, and I understood that. I would love to have taken me to a parking lot and said, Lorna, you wait here, I'll be back. And, you know, and there's something about me that has to be different. I am different. And by the way, you know, I cannot be found in bars. I cannot be found serving alcohol. I cannot, sometimes it's necessary for us, you know, on 12-step work to do that sort of thing. But as a part of my daily life, I don't do it. I don't pretend
that that this is an ordinary thing that has happened to me. And I don't pretend that, you know, I try not to pretend that it's ordinary, or that I want someone to be able to look at me and see that there's something about that woman that's a little different. There's something about the way she likes herself. There's something about the way she won't tolerate abuse or anything. I like that. And that was the thing that fascinated me about you. I was fascinated that you could say no. I had no idea how to say no. You know, I had coffee with you and I gave you the keys to my apartment. It was that sort of thing that intrigued me. And my sponsor captured me by saying, you know, Lorna, if you stay with us, you will be able to develop a life that will be like having a quiver of golden arrows on your back. And when you come into a situation in life that you're not too sure how to handle, you'll be able to reach back, select the perfect arrow, put it in your bow, and hit bullseye every time. And it was like, ooh, you know, I mean, so intoxicating to me that I could hit bullseye every time. I was, to me it translated, I could be appropriate. I was never appropriate. You know, I was the sort that was wearing plunging necklines at funerals. And, you know, I always laughed too loudly or inappropriately. No one ever said anything to me about my drinking. No one ever said, you know, you drink too much and why don't you curb your drinking? People said things to me like, shh, or do you mind, or, you know, you're very spiteful. And so I was thinking of that, and, you know, I just got sober. I used to think I was very speedy. And, you know, when I was 2 years sober, actually, you should have asked me to speak when I was 2 years sober because I knew it all. And, you know, as I said, you know, around 2 years of sobriety, but I had to get sober very gradually and the awareness of it all. And I often like to tell this story about my appearance. You know, I think when I walked into AA, I thought you took one look at me and you thought to yourselves, God, thank God Lorna has arrived. You know, now we can hold our heads up high because we don't have to be quite so anonymous because she is with us. She adds great tone and class to AA. And that's what I thought you thought. Meanwhile, in reality, what was happening was you were patting me on the back in that way you do, you know, and you said to me in that kind voice, dear, you keep coming back. You're in the right place. And while I on one side felt like I added great tone and class, on the other side I thought, oh my God, you know, I hope they don't kick me out. I don't really belong. I haven't drunk. And when they find out that I don't really drink and, you know, I don't have a story, can't talk about severed limbs or anything like that. And, you know, I always say I always wanted to get up with a great scar on my face. And then people would nudge each other knowingly and they'd whisper, bottle fight on Avenue D. And, you know, I wanted some badge that would let you know. But anyway, my appearance was a little bizarre. I came in, I'd been wearing the same dress for the last 3 months. I mean, I had other clothes to wear, but I couldn't be bothered to put another outfit together. I was just too busy. And I was festooned in jewelry. I had masses of jewelry. Now, I came in 1976, and in 1976, I had 4 piercings in one ear. And, you know, I always say how grateful I am that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous before the craze of tattooing and piercing came out, because I'm sure I would have had the Last Supper put on my chest or something, you know. So, or a plate put in my lower lip, something like that, you know. I wouldn't have been satisfied with a discreet little flower in my nose. So I was festooned in jewellery, and I wore gobs and gobs and gobs of makeup. I mean, I wore makeup. And I wore a lot of kohl around my eyes. I thought I looked very fetching, but I looked more like, you know those guys that play football and they put that thing around their eyes, or I looked like a badger or something, or a raccoon. I was very odd looking, but I wondered how you knew I was new, you know? And I had very long hair when I came into the program, and you know, most women have long hair because they want to do things with it. They want to, you know, dress it and wear it up or down or fiddle with it. But this hair was I grew my hair long, I think, so I could be tortured. And I wore it. Oh, I was just wanted to say, you know, about this makeup. I didn't take it off at night. I was like Elizabeth I. I just slathered more on every single day. And I wore my hair in tight braids going across the top of my head. And I wore it like that because I could keep it up for 3 and 4 days at a time. You know, I wanted a hairstyle forever. I wanted my hair done. And I fancied I looked like Heidi, but I looked more like Mrs. Danvers at the top of the staircase. You know, I was totally crazy looking when I look back now. Absolutely wild. You know, I often say that when people do their fifth steps, they often say, you know, I don't want to tell you who I am. I don't want to reveal myself. Oh, sister, you know, you knew who I was 5 blocks away, around corners. You could see me coming. I mean, as soon as I appeared in the doorway, you nudged and said, here's a live one. And it was just so ridiculous. But anyway, I was trying. I did try. And when I was a few months sober, you know, I was the first woman art auctioneer in America. And I had this very, very public job. And for a long time, I'd been dressing, at the end of my drinking, I'd been dressing out of thrift shops. I had started to go into thrift shops because I could buy the odd handbag or the odd jacket to accent an outfit. Now I was clothing myself out of thrift shops because I couldn't face a department store. I just couldn't face it. It was too much for me to, it was too overwhelming. And one day, someone at work came up to me, and very nicely, very sweetly, she took me aside. And in this kind voice, she asked me, as one would ask a patient, she asked me, Lorna, why are you wearing a maid's uniform? And, you know, as soon as she asked it, I sort of took a look at myself and I realized, oh my God, it's right. It had the little cuff and the belt and the collar and everything. And I had bought it in the thrift shop because it made me look neat and tidy. And I was desperately trying to keep it together. And it's a wonder when people came, you know, to sell their collections, they didn't give me their coat to hang up. So, but now I'm in sobriety doing, you know, gradually, sobriety. And the years, I don't know, you know, all my hour is almost up. And here I am, I just haven't... I'm still into my drinking, but my experience, my strength is that I think the most important piece of literature, the two important pieces of literature in the program, I think they're the most important pieces of literature. One is the preamble, and the other one is my meeting book. And I've always carried a meeting book with me, and I think, you know, I've done a lot of things unorthodox in the program, but I've always gone to meetings, and I've always talked to you, and I've always let you know exactly what I'm doing, and been in meetings. I can't believe that this amount of time has gone by. So my strength. That actually is my strength. My strength is meetings. And, you know, I believe that the first 2 years of sobriety are all about learning how to say no, No, I can't come home for Thanksgiving. No, I will not have a relationship. No, I can't be there. No, whatever it is. And the whole rest of my life has been learning how to say yes. Yes, I do love you. Yes, I will commit to a relationship. Yes, I will show up. Yes, I will do service. Yes, I will be the district representative. Yes, I will be there for you. And all those sorts of things. And yes, I will take a new job. Yes, I will move to another state. You know, it is said that ships are safe in the harbor, but ships aren't built for the harbor. And I can be very, very safe in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I also have to, you know, if I'm in the third step, Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me that I must take a risk. And that I must risk and go out there and take my boat on the high seas. And I can't always be worrying, well, am I going to get hurt? Am I going to have enough money? What's it going to be like? Have I got my shots? All that sort of stuff. Just to go out and to risk it. It's Alcoholics Anonymous is not about me becoming contained and small. It's about me becoming larger and larger. And, you know, this is not something I get through my mind. It's something I love the saying, Cousin Sucker says, the mind is Satan's lawyer and the heart is God's servant. And, you know, I cannot think this. And, you know, people often come up to me after I've spoken and said to me, how did you get out of that pain, by the way? And I always forget to say it. And I can't tell you. Time put me out of that pain. It was just time. It was the final surrender when one day I realized I heard the sound of myself laughing. And one day I realized I had a lightness of heart. And one day I realized I was listening to someone in a room that was sharing about her cat dying. And I always thought, good God, she's sharing about her cat dying. My God, she needs something to be upset about. And I realized that woman's in pain. And for me not to judge someone else's pain. And when I realized that sort of thing, I realized I was coming through it and that I'd been taught many great lessons. And you know, there's two things that have happened to me recently that I'd like to share with you in closing. And they're two things that have been very, very important to me. And When we talk about in the program that the program will be beyond our wildest dreams, I've listened to that for 23 years, and I've always thought, well, I could have thought of something far wilder than this. This is not my wild dream at all. But I have a brother. And he's years older than me. And I came to America when I was 18 years old. And a few years ago. And I've had a very estranged relationship with him. Why? I don't know. There was never any big argument. It was just the way we were to each other. But I've always had this longing for him. And he hasn't had this longing for me. And I want to say to any man in the room, you know, it's such a phenomenal thing for a woman to have a brother, especially an older brother. And I had this real longing for my brother. And I tried everything with this relationship, you know, but he just seemed to be disinterested in me, just totally not interested. And to cut a long story short, I went home this past summer in August, and he lives in Yorkshire, and he invited me to come up. And with the advent of email, we corresponded with each other more than we had over the last 30-odd years. And he invited me. He said, you know, if you please come and see us. So I took the train up to Leeds. And he, all the way on the train, I said, God, please just let me be a presence of love. Let me just not bring up the past. Let me not talk about, you know, you never called, you never wrote, you never, you know, you haven't let me had a relationship with the children. Why haven't you ever invited me for Christmas? Or please let me not harp on the past. Please let me be in this moment with my brother that I don't see very often because I live 3,000 miles away. Let me have whatever I can have. And let me give. And I got there, and I want to tell you that I had the most fantastic weekend with this man and his wife. So wonderful. It was so terrific, you know, and it was his time too. He had a need for a sister. And he had, and it was so miraculous for me to hear my name said gently and nicely on my brother's lips. It was such a blessing for me. And I did, with God's strength and your example, I was able to talk about pleasant things and nice memories from childhood. And I didn't bring up one negative thing, not one. And, you know, I realized that in doing Ninth Step work, I've been in the program a long time, and I've listened, and I have an emotional development that maybe other people don't have. And it's not fair for me to unload that on someone that's, especially if they're English, you know. And anyway, I was supposed to leave. I got there on a Friday, and I was supposed to leave on the Sunday at 1 o'clock. That was my train. And my brother kept me till 6. He kept on saying, oh, there's another train, and let me just show you this and that. Anyway, the time came, and he drove me to a station that was 40 minutes away when he could have driven me to one that was 10 minutes away. And we got to the station. It was just he and myself, and I had the ticket in my hand, and I'm going through the barrier. And we'd said goodbye to each other. And as I got to the barrier, I thought to myself, you know, I'm in a program that says the good is the enemy of the best. And I went back to him, this man I'm a little frightened of, whose approval I want, whose love is very important to me, and who I know can't stand emotional outbursts. And I said, Sean, there's something I have to say to you, and it's very difficult. And I could see him getting a little like, oh God, I thought I was getting away with this whole weekend, you know. And I said to him, you know, if there's anything I've ever done or said that in any way has wanted you to separate from me, I am truly sorry. And by this time, you know, I'm in the middle of the station and I'm weeping. And my brother, I don't know, it was right for him too. He put his arms around me and he said, yes, I understand. It's all right. You know, and just that, I understand. And it's what we say to each other, you know. I know how you feel. And just, it was just such a, it might not sound very much for you, but, you know, the arrogance of me, I heard that you had healed relationships in this program. I heard that you had healed relationships with parents and things like that. And my relationships with my parents were very healed when they died. But I thought, this particular relationship will never happen for me. I listened to you, but this was different. This was my brother, and this was not going to happen. And it happened for me too. And, you know, I'm so grateful. And I have a sister, and it's not quite so good with her. But we're doing this one sibling at a time. And and the last thing I want to share, something that's happened to me in the last few weeks. So this is a wonderful time for me and a wonderful opportunity to share this incredible thing that's happened to me. And, you know, very often I will downplay incredible things in my life, but this is something that all of us get to share in. Last year I wrote a book. It was all about myself. It's absolutely fascinating. But a lot of it's to do with my life, my spiritual life, and a lot of it's to do with mother and myself. Anyway, earlier this year I was contacted by, you know, they want to make Mother Teresa a saint. She's going through that canonization process. And I was contacted by the Missionaries of Charity, her sisters, her nuns, if I would, please would I submit copies of my personal letters from Mother to the tribunal, which I was very, I thought, ooh, that's, whew, yes, absolutely. So I Xeroxed all of my personal letters from her, and I sent those off, and I felt very pleased. And then I found out this summer that was not requested of me, but I found out that my book had been submitted and requested. And someone in the program said to me, ooh, you know, the Pope's probably in bed at night drinking his cocoa and reading your book. And I felt very, very honored, you know. And when they say in the program that it will be beyond our wildest dreams, my wild dreams, I know, entailed money, men, and mansions. You know, it was... And hot and cold running servants. I mean, something along those lines. I think when it says beyond our wildest dreams, it means... my wild dreams are pretty tacky compared to what... It has to be beyond that. And a few weeks ago, I came home, and in my mailbox was an envelope. And on the envelope, it said, Metropolitan Tribunal, Archdiocese of New York. And I thought, ooh, they've caught me. They've caught me probably sleeping in church or something. And I opened the envelope, and in this was a letter written in very churchy language, requesting that the Archbishop of Calcutta had contacted John Cardinal O'Connor of New York, and asked that he call me to give my formal testimony into the life virtues and reputation for the sanctity of the servant of God, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. So, ladies and gentlemen, you are looking at a witness to a saint. And you know, it's pretty fabulous, let's face it. I feel so 14th century, and you know, I just think it's so phenomenal that, I mean, I'm thrilled, I'm absolutely thrilled to be, and I'm so honored. I'm one of 18 in America to be called to do this. And, you know, who am I that I get this honor except that I'm Lorna Kelly of Alcoholics Anonymous? I belong to a program, and I belong to you, and you belong to me, and it wasn't just me going before that tribunal. It was all of us. And when I went in, you know, to show you how deeply shallow I am, the first thought when I got this letter was, ooh, you know, what an honor, how terrific. And my second thought was, what on earth will I wear? And And, you know, God has used this very imperfect instrument to bring forth something so wonderful. And what is so incredible about it is that my wild dream, I wouldn't have even, if you had said to me when I came in the program, you know, sweetheart, if you stay sober, you can help some little old lady in Calcutta become a saint. I'd be like, please. It's not really my idea, but it's that my wild dream has entailed something that has nothing to do with me. It's got nothing to do with me being a saint. It's got something to do totally with someone else. I am only a tiny, tiny, tiny cog in this wheel, and I am so grateful. However, if any of you want to know what went on, I will tell you, because when my turn comes, I want you to know what to do. And so I want to thank you. We all are there, you know, we all go. So I want to thank you all so much for going to meetings, for reading the literature, for doing service, for putting money in the basket. Never ever let the basket pass by without contributing. For getting the alcohol out of your house, for doing all the things you do, for saying yes to all the things you do, because if you weren't here and you didn't do those things, I wouldn't have that brother, I wouldn't have any life at all, and those doors surely would have closed on my life forever. So thank you for your sobriety.